begin with a word of prayer. Gracious God, we thank you for this morning. We thank you for this amazing world that you have made, that we get to be a part of. And we pray that as you are teaching us throughout our life, that we will have open minds and hearts and ears, and that also as we learn, we'll have the courage to follow you, the places you want us to be, and into the relationships you want us to have. Bless our time of study this morning. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you for being here today. I sent you off with a question yesterday. What verse do you think in Genesis 6, 3 through 6 is the saddest verse in the Bible? Anybody have any guesses?
Mine is 6:6, where God repented of making us.
Anybody else?
6:17.
What does that say?
Okay. Curiously looking here.
Bring a flood.
6:17. For my part, I'm going to bring a flood of waters to destroy from under heaven all flesh, in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on earth shall die.
Okay.
Joshua 3:10. I heard you in the garden, I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. Hiding from God, I think it's a pretty sad thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, you're on track. And you'll see how it sort of fits in as we go along here. Yesterday, our Bible study was God's evolving story of life. Eden was good, not perfect. We talked about the vastness of God's creation and the ancientness and the oldness of God's creation. When you think of the universe, but also our own planet, we talked about how the earth being the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and in the Creator's house there are many, many dwelling places. And if you're into physics, you maybe think in terms of how everything is made up of atoms, tiny little atoms. And a trillion atoms can fit on the head of a pin. And the electrons of an atom go around the nucleus a trillion times in a trillionth of a second. And if you're into chemistry, you maybe think about how the electrons of those atoms sometimes join together to form compounds or molecules, like table salt, or H2O, or carbon dioxide. And if you're into biology, you think about how those molecules come together to form cells that have proteins and enzymes and DNA. And if you're into physiology, you think about how those cells come together to form structures like a leaf or a stem or a bone or a nose or a body. And if you're into ecology, you think about how those structures come together to form ecosystems, which are part of larger ecosystems, which are part of larger ecosystems. And you get a sense that the Creator's house has many, many dwelling places, and the Creator's house is not just heaven, but it's the whole universe, including our planet, including the vastness, and even the tininess. Some people think about outer space seeming to be infinite. Inner space might be infinite too. If you could keep on having more powerful microscopes, you just keep going. And there's something called neutrinos. I was reading an article about this, that a subatomic, smaller than that, and there are trillions of those things going through us right now, just all over the place, and space is filled with those. So the Father's house, the Creator's house, has many, many dwelling places. And we looked at this kind of timeline here, thinking about when the universe began 13.7 billion years ago, and planet Earth 4.6, and life beginning about 3.8, and kind of going all the way up here, and primates, and Homo sapiens when we came on the scene, and we thought about Yeah. And we also talked about how, and I got this learning from Daniel Erlander in his book, Man and Mercy. Eden was tov, which means good. It wasn't perfect. And the idea of perfection is a Western civilization concept that was imposed on the Hebrew mind. Hebrews didn't think in those terms. God made the world good. And we talked about good including all kinds of things, from beautiful sunsets to also hurricanes, from life to death. God made the garden good. And I think part of our problem is, as humans, we don't think that's good enough. We don't think good is good enough. And so we want to remake God's world. And in our pursuit of what we think is better, or perfection, which I call an addiction, we're actually making the creation worse. We talked a little bit about how in one creation story, the Adam, the human creature, was created from the Adama, the soil. So we are earthlings made from the stuff, the soil. And how we're connected to that, and we come from there, and we'll return to there. We talked about possibly in the Genesis 1 story, when God said, "Let us make humankind in our image," God might have been talking to all the creatures he had just made. And that perhaps humans are made in the image of God and in the image of all other creatures. And we forget either at our peril. Or probably we've forgotten one or both or the other. And we talked about how God's story of life is, and the reign of God is just so vast. And it's so old. I was in South Africa in 1994, the week before the first ever democratic elections they had ever had in that country, when Nelson Mandela was elected. And the church people we were staying with, somebody worked in a gold mine, so we got a tour of a gold mine. So here we were in South Africa, 4,000 feet underground. And I picked up a stone, and I asked the geologist that was with us, "How old is this?" He said, "Well, about 2.6 billion years old."
Wow.
I brought it home to a geology friend of mine. If you've ever been to Hawaii, anybody been on the Big Island or Hawaii or other islands? That's the newest rock on Earth. So you literally may be walking on some rock that came on the scene, you know, a couple of years ago. So God's story is vast in God's story. So let me ask, what were there any thoughts you had now from yesterday's presentation? Let's just take a minute here to just reflect. Any thoughts or questions or insights that you had from yesterday?
Well, I think I mentioned to you yesterday that your timeline puts Homo sapien in a better perspective, I think, for me. Mm-hmm. You know, especially when you ask the question, you know, what does that mean? What indications does that have for Judaism and Christianity and those things? I had just that timeline really puts everything in perspective, just how, you know, minuscule we are and how important we make ourselves, mm-hmm. when really the plan is so much larger than us.
Mm. Yes?
I found it interesting. You said something about new species are still mm-hmm. evolving,
yeah.
where I think, you know, a more literal reading of yeah. the Old Testament says, you know, we're the final creation,
yeah.
we're the ultimate, the top of the pyramid. But your statement about the things are still evolving, there's still new species being created, put it into perspective too for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about the numbers of us that are
coming to be, even and how much we need to learn to get along.
Yeah.
Because we need to share.
Yes, when you put it into perspective that God said to the creation that he had made to that point, let us make, that opened to me a whole imagery that in our day, as we engage in creation with creative possibilities, then we are partnering with God in the creative unfolding of the world he has made. That to me was very, very enlightening.
When you talked about the Big Island and specifically Kilauea, the volcano, yeah, creating new earth,
yeah,
many years ago I had a profound experience that I didn't expect to have. We walked right to where the lava was entering the sea from Kilauea, yeah, the red stuff.
Yeah.
And I'd always had a dream of sticking a stick in the lava, and I was able to do that, but touched literally that ancient creative force, that reality.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize how profoundly it would affect me, but I was changed after that.
Yeah. And then just the more we learn, just the more amazing things are, yes.
Is there a reliable measurement of this timeline?
Reliable. There are ways, but it's estimates, and you know, in terms of how you date things, is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's carbon dating. There's a number of other things that I don't even understand, and you think you get close. But again, that's a tool. There's a lot we don't know, and a person could say, "Well, that's just a guess," and it isn't. That kind of leads to—I don't know if you're thinking about these sort of things, but there's kind of a spectrum in how people tend to think. There's the creationists who believe that the Earth is about 6,000 years old. And everything was created then as it is now. So every species was created. A squirrel was made a squirrel, and a human was made a human, and so forth. Anybody been to the Creation Museum in Kentucky? You can go there. This is there. And this came from James Usher in the 1600s from England, who did this calculation. He added up the generations in Genesis and all this and said, the earth was created in 4004 BC. I think he had the day and the time too. But a lot of people kind of accepted this. It was put into the margins of some of the King James Version Bibles that this was the story of life. Everything was created as is. And at this creation museum, you have people in the displays. There are people and dinosaurs kind of at the same time. And then there's something called intelligent design that says, well, there could be evolution or there could not. The world could be 6,000 years old or 13.7 billion years old, the universe. But when you break things down to their smallest parts, there seems to be a design, an intelligence that is making an eye, for example. There's something so profound about that. Or the fact that electrons go around the nucleus of an atom, and there's a force that keeps them going around, and there's a force that keeps it connected with the nucleus so that they either don't just fly off or that they don't cave in to the center. And there must be some kind of intelligence going on. And then there's a view called God of the Gaps that says there are basically four gaps. One is how did nothing become something? Stephen Hawking's, anybody read his latest book, The Grand Design? You read the brief history of time? Yeah. He has come up with a theory, as I understand it, to respond to that. He says, it's just as likely that there has always been something, statistically, as it is that there was nothing at one time and then something came. So, some would say, well, God is in that gap between nothing and something. Another gap is, how did non-life become life? How did chemistry evolve into biology? That's another gap. Another one is, I alluded to it, it took over 3 billion years for single cell life to evolve into multiple cell life. That's a long time. There must have been kind of a great leap that took place. And God maybe is in that gap. And then the fourth gap is something called consciousness. What is consciousness? Some species, including our own, seem to have that. Is it a bunch of electrons doing something? Or is it something else? And so some would say that's where God is, in that gap. And then evolutionary biology would say there may be a God, and you can believe in a God, but you don't need a God figure for evolution to work. It's not like there's a watchmaker that's making a watch. It's not that it's a more intelligent being making something less intelligent. Evolution sort of bubbles up from underneath, and less complex things evolve into more complex things. So, I don't know where I'm right here somewhere. I understand evolutionary biology more and more, and find it fascinating. And I believe in God. Now I don't know how that goes together. But Tom, were you going to say something?
Well, I was just curious about Teilhard de Chardin's perspective that the universe is intrinsically intelligent, which is quite different from intelligent design, and how that kind of fits into your spectrum there.
I don't know. Where do you think that would fit?
Well, I actually had to put it off to the other side of evolutionary biology, off there in that leftward direction, because it certainly honors evolutionary biology, but it says there isn't something outside that's creating it, but that the universe itself is intrinsically intelligent in a way that it evolves purposefully.
Yeah. And in evolutionary biology, I think basically says there is no forethought. There's no plan. There's no purpose. It's everything is just kind of tinkering and reacting to the things around it and going through time. And you're saying that maybe another view would say that is true, but there's also some larger purpose or something to it.
That it has an intrinsic intelligence that goes to the level of neutrinos and quarks and below.
Okay.
That moves as a whole.
My view of it is God is the answer to why evolution happens, not how it happens. Like he had the way that he just said, like he made it so that we'd evolve, not that he makes us how we are. He is why we evolve, not how we just got here.
One of my, when I was young, when I dropped out of the Christian faith, in fact, I dropped out of even being a deist, but to come back there as a biologist or in the field of biology was to think about infinity, the hereafter, going on and on and on. And I can intuit that very, very well. I can understand that, it seems clear to me. Mm-hmm. But to think the other way, having no beginning, mm-hmm. I absolutely have no intuition or ability to understand that. And perhaps Stephen Hawking or perhaps yourself has some answer to the concept of no beginning. I've never been able to wrap my mind around that. In fact, it was something that, because I couldn't do that, that God filled that space for just the start of getting back to deism and then Christianity for me.
I think Stephen Hawking would say, okay, if you want to say that God is the one who got it all going, who got God going? And then you could say, well, God's eternal. And then he would probably say, well, maybe other things are eternal too. So, anyway, it just really, you almost get a headache after a while. But it's fascinating, and it helps us to start thinking about our place, as you're saying. Did you want to say something, Catherine?
I want to add to your headache. Catherine Keller's written a book, it's called On the Theology of Becoming. So Catherine takes the phrase, creatio ex nihilo, creation from nothing, and using the first verses of Genesis, she works with the idea of creatio ex profundis, creation from the deep. It is not, according to her, creation from nothing. It is from the tahom, which is complex and dark, but not empty, and certainly not nothing.
The spirit so, moved upon the face of the water.
Of the tahom, which is not nothing. Yeah, right. And in the Hebrew scholars don't consider it nothing.
Right.
So Everett Fox translates that verse, at the beginning of God's creating, not in the beginning of the creation.
Yeah.
So it's very different.
It's amazing.
It's a big headache.
Well, we've solved Bible study one. We've got all that figured out. Now we're going to move on to Bible study two.
Now we got that figured out.
look at the fall. I left you with some questions. I said, well, if God's evolving story of life and the reign of God is so vast, and if it is so ancient, why are Judaism and Christianity so recent? Oops. And why is the message of the Old Testament and New Testament seem to be at its core the reign of God, the kingdom of God? And why is that message addressed to our particular species? And I don't have an answer to that question, those questions, but I have a theory. And that's what I kind of want to share with you here this morning. My theory is that about 5, 6, 7, 8, 9,000 years ago, after a couple hundred thousand years of living fairly responsibly as a species, as part of the whole community of life, a new narrative began to emerge in the minds of some Homo sapiens. If you can imagine the earth populated with thousands of cultures. Any part of the country that you live in, if you study native history, you'll know that there were various cultures that lived in the land. I live in Arizona, and there's a couple of dozen. The Hopis and the Pascoyakis and so forth. So if you can imagine the world populated by all these cultures, and in general, the peoples had a worldview that they were part of the creation. They were part of the community of life. But several thousand years ago, in some places, a new narrative began to emerge. And that narrative was, rather than the earth belongs to the whole community of life, including Homo sapiens, that narrative was now think of the sort of the profound shift going on there. The earth belongs to the whole community of life, including Homo sapiens, was changed to the earth belongs to Homo sapiens. Now, it didn't happen just one day. It happened over generations and generations, but it became more and more of a worldview that caught on. That rather than the earth is the Lord's, or the earth is the whole community of life, and we get to be a part of that, the earth is ours. That's sometimes called human exceptionalism. The notion started to emerge that humans are special. We're more special than other creatures. In fact, we're more special than all of the creatures on earth put together. We started to think of ourselves as separate from the creation. Superior to the creation. The reason for the creation, it was made for us. And the rulers of the creation. And this human exceptionalist view, I would argue, has become the dominant narrative of our species in the last several thousand years. It is the air we breathe. It is the airwaves that bombard us all day and night. It's the given of every nursery rhyme, every textbook, every graduation speech, whether it's by the president of the college or the valedictorian or the visiting person getting an honorary doctorate. It's the given of every newscast, of every president's speech, every politician, every commercial on TV, everything. It is the given that the world belongs to humans. The Greek philosopher Pythagoras, 5th century BCE, said, man is the measure of all things. We're the standard. Francis Bacon said it another way. Man, if we look to final causes, may be regarded as the center of the world, insomuch that if man were taken away from the world, the rest would seem to be all astray, without aim or purpose. I would argue that that is the foundation of Western civilization and other civilizations now, and that it's the dominant narrative of our species. And the other narrative has almost been squashed out. It has made us a conquistador towards God's creation. It has made us a dominator towards the community of life. It has made us a taker. The creed is, the world is a jungle, a dangerous, deficient, defiant, disorderly enemy. It is wild, it needs to be tamed. Broken, it needs to be fixed. Inept at self-rule, it needs to be conquered. A wasteland, and needs to be developed. We talk about developing land. And we do it sometimes humorously. I grew up in Minneapolis, and we had relatives on farms in southern Minnesota. And kind of a joke that you'd hear from farmers, you'd go and you'd say, man, this cornfield is just beautiful. And they would say, yeah, you should have seen it when just the Lord had it. It's inadequate. I'm suggesting that this is what the biblical fall story is about. The biblical storytellers, and I got this idea from Daniel Quinn. Anybody read Daniel Quinn? Ishmael, the story of B. Yeah. Oh man, it just opened up all kinds of windows and doors for me. But that's what the fall story is about. After a couple hundred thousand years of living fairly responsibly as a species, our species began to go nuts several thousand years ago. And at the core of it is that we began to adopt this new narrative that the world belongs to us. We declared, rather than life under the reign of God, for the sake of the whole community of life, including Homo sapiens, we declared the reign of God. We left the Creator's house and God's reign and instead declared our house and our reign. Now, if you believe in creationism and that the world was made in 6 days, 6,000 years ago, it might make sense to put humans somewhat prominently. But if we think about that timeline, as you said, we've been here the tiniest fraction of time. The tiniest fraction of time. And yet we think, well, it was just sort of getting ready for us. That's what those 13.7 billion years were. Getting ready for us. So this is sometimes called human exceptionalism. And in our Christian theology, we have bought into this. And we talk about how God loves us so much. I've preached sermons like that. God loves you so much. And the more O's we have, the larger your church will be. That's sometimes called human exceptionalism, sometimes it's called narcissism. A colleague of mine calls it diva theology. That it's all about us. And I'm suggesting that that's what the fall story was about. And as we began to live that way, and as our narrative was that this world belongs to us, we began to behave as though the world belongs to us. See, that's what we do as humans. We live out our narrative. A family system has a narrative, each of our family systems. And whether we know it or not, we're living out things from that. I was in email conversation with a former student who's in the Peace Corps in the Ukraine, and I think in his mind he thinks he just decided to go into the Peace Corps. And I suggested to him, you know, I bet there's something in your family system that you're just kind of living out that has come from a generation ago or maybe two or three. Also, nations have a narrative that we live out. And we can think of kind of the, you know, American narratives that we are living out. And species do too. And I think, I'm suggesting that the narrative of our species now, the dominant narrative, is that the world belongs to us. And we've gotten out of relationship because of that. We've become out of relationship with God's creation. We have begun to think of God's creation as a thing, as an it, as a commodity. And as we become more and more out of relationship with God's creation, we have more and more begun to suffer from a nature deficit disorder. That's a phrase from I forget who. Or as one farmer put it, the farther we get away from the dirt, the more neurotic we become. We become out of relationship with our neighbor, our human neighbor. And, of course, as Christians, we know Jesus said, Ron, your neighbor is not just people you like or people like you. Ron, your neighbor is the stranger and the strange one. Your neighbor is the outcast and the one who's been cast out. Your neighbor is the alien, even the illegal alien. And we became more and more out of relationship with our neighbor. Our neighbor can also be those very close to us. We became out of relationship with our inner spirit and soul and self. And I don't think having more screens in front of our faces and more earphones in our ears and more things to do with our thumbs is necessarily leading us in the right direction. And we became out of relationship with God. That's from the movie
Bruce
Almighty. Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Like from what's here, what happened first
in the order of things, because it seemed the way you're presenting it seems like our idea was that we got messed up with creation first, whereas if you read Genesis 3, it's that it was the relationship with God that you're right, right. We didn't want to be under his rule, but it happened with him first, and that was what caused the disconnect with everything else. And so the first relationship that has to be restored is to the Lord.
I wanted to phrase it, we became out of relationship with God's creation, out of relationship with our neighbor, with our inner spirit, soul, and self, and with the ground of it all.
But that was the first in our rejection of his reign, his rule, his him above all else. Instead, we put ourselves there, and that caused the out of whack with everything else. When you read this, that's what it's saying first. It doesn't say that we went out and we did things to creation first. It said at first we decided in a prideful way, I don't want to do what God asked me to do. I don't want to obey. I want to be under his reign. I want to be under my own. And then that went out from there into all our relationships with one another and then out to creation. And so if you restore the God relationship, it should restore all the others rather than restoring the other relationships, getting you back to God. So I just want to clarify what you're saying with that.
I would say that's one way to look at it. But I think I'd also say that it all goes together.
Definitely, it's how you come at the Bible.
So if
you're coming at it, taking what you're saying right directly from the text versus a different view. So that might be where
I would agree that that's maybe the biblical witness of those storytellers, and I would say I would see it a little differently.
That's where the bottom line,
listening between us would be. Right. I would say it all goes together. If we're out of relationship with one, it affects the others.
But where does it start?
I guess I don't see a need to have a start, but we may disagree on that. I think one produces the other three, no matter where you start.
Mm-hmm. In the Hebrew Bible, it's the human person is a nephesh, and there's no way of taking apart the God part from the human part.
So nephesh is spirit, or wind, right?
No, it's the whole being. It's the person. That's ruach, the spirit. So the nephesh is both our relationship with God and with each other and creation. There's no way of separating what we do with God with what we do with the creation. It does not come apart. It only happens in Greek. And so we do need to stay with the nephesh because it's not separatable.
So
if one part is missing, then the disconnect will sink with the rest of the parts.
So was eating from the fruit of the tree of knowledge when we became sapien, and then we knew good from evil, and we therefore put ourselves in a position of us being reigning rather than God reigning, because we cut seven and see. We had a conscious level that was different from before. Before we became sapien, we were just living because we're just in community with the whole creation, and then at some point the light bulb went on, and...
Okay, let me go just a little bit further, and I'll get back to these, because I think it'll come clear as I go further here. As we adopted this worldview, and I'm suggesting that that's what the fall story is about, that we became out of relationship. And the biblical storytellers created parables to try and express what they saw happening. So if we can imagine the biblical storytellers living in their part of the world and kind of noticing neighbors in another culture behaving in a different way. What's wrong with those people? They seem to be living as though the world belongs to them. Maybe they ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And this is, I'm saying this is a parable. And the tree of knowledge of good and evil, I'm suggesting, represents God's reign, God's domain, God being the one who's in charge. And the story of eating from there is trespassing into God's domain and taking it for our own species. Now, it gets a little complicated here, but let me just kind of say this. So I'm not saying, I'm not one that believes that there was an actual Adam and Eve, and that they were the first parents, and they had sex with each other, and with their kids, and the kids had with each other, and with their uncles and aunts and cousins, and that's how the world was populated. And that's pretty much, I don't think you would find a Lutheran pastor or a Methodist or an Episcopal or a Presbyterian or a seminary professor or a bishop or in those denominations that believe Adam and Eve were actual people, that were the first people on earth.
Well, I know a lot of Lutheran pastors who believe exactly.
Yeah? Yes. Okay. Not in the ELCA, maybe.
Well, I don't know everybody.
Right. I'm suggesting that there are very few people that I know anyway in my denomination that would see Adam and Eve as actual people, and that this story is an actual story. Where my denomination tends to be is that Adam and Eve kind of are symbolic of issues in our makeup as human beings. With the fall story, we disobey God, and when we disobey God, we hide, and when we disobey God, we blame. So, Adam blamed Eve. Eve blamed the serpent. The serpent blamed God. And those are sort of timeless truths about our species. What I'm suggesting is that there's a third thing, and that is that this is a story written in an actual historical time, trying to address actual historical things that the storytellers were observing and seeing. That they were starting to notice a behavior in some parts of the human community that had shifted the narrative from living under the reign of God as part of the whole community of life, and have supplanted that narrative with the reign of humans. And the parables were to try and express what was happening there. Sometimes we think that, well, why did God say don't eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil? And we think, well, he was testing their obedience. Well, in a way, that's kind of like parents putting a loaded gun on the kitchen table and telling their kids not to touch it. I'm wondering if there's something else going on. That God said, stay away from my domain because you can't handle it. And if you start messing with running the world, there's going to be a lot that goes wrong. And so God said, don't touch this in this story as a way of saving us from ourselves and saving the world from us. So it's historical in the sense it's a parable trying to address real things happening. So it's not just symbolic, but it's not sort of an actual story. And I know it's a little complicated, but and so that would make, as you, if you kind of put this together, that I don't really think that the fall story is talking about something called original sin. I think it's talking about this change in human thinking that began to occur fairly recently. And it's trying to make sense of this. What is happening? Because it's starting to see the effects of it. That we are in over our heads. Now, the traditional view is that sin entered the world now. And so that from that moment on, a baby born in South Dakota or India or Nigeria was sinful. And the traditional view is that when that happened, kind of sin entered the creation. So that now we have earthquakes. And now we have tornadoes. Now we have death. And from our thing yesterday, I was trying to make the point that that's part of the way God made the world. The problem is, I'm suggesting that this story is saying humans, as this parable, ate from God's domain, and we ate the fruit, but as a human creature, we can't digest it. And our problem is, we eat the fruit, and we think it is making us wise. But we're not digesting it. So really, we are in over our heads. So we're like a two-year-old doing laser eye surgery. We're like a three-year-old flying a 747. We're like a mere politician or a mere general given the authority to launch weapons of mass destruction. We are in over our head. And the whole creation groans in travail. In this new view, it says the garden was made for humans. We must conquer it. Do these names ring a bell? Those two were the first to summit Mount Everest. When Edmund Hillary died in 2008, I believe it was, the newspaper article that I read said that they had conquered Everest. Well, if you've ever been on a big mountain like that, and I've hiked them before, the last thing you've done is conquer. We must rule it. We must use it as desired and discard the rest as expendable. I was driving home from church a few weeks ago, listening to a preacher on TV, or on the radio, not on TV, who said, the earth is like a paper towel. You use it up and throw it away. Well, we should not stop our quest to command land, sea, sky, weather, wildlife, bacteria, genes, etc., until this holy mission is fulfilled and creation lies bleeding at our feet, until we have transformed both God and nature into our image. And the whole creation is going into travail, including our species, because we're part of the creation. We like to think in terms of, well, there's human beings and then there's the environment. Every book, every newscast is framed that way. I would suggest that there's only the environment, which includes human beings. But we have done this kind of dichotomy. Four things to say about this narrative. First of all, no other species on Earth concurs. Agrees. Secondly, I'm suggesting this is a recent narrative in our species. The fourth thing I'm suggesting is God doesn't agree. And the fifth or the fourth thing I'm suggesting is that Christianity has mistakenly become the keeper of this narrative. Has become the organism that provides religious sanction and holy cover for this narrative. And we get then to the saddest verse in the Bible. The Lord was sorry that he had made humankind on earth, and it grieved him to his heart. And he sought a way to destroy us for the sake of the world. But he must have thought about it and thought, well, can a mother destroy one of her kids? Can a father kill one of his children? So instead of destroy us, God must have decided, well, maybe I can fix these creatures. Maybe I can heal them. So, the gospel is then, which is the rest of the Bible after Genesis 6:6, possibly, is God, besides God's primary mission, which is the evolving story of life, God has decided to take on a secondary mission, and that is to try and heal our species. God has a primary mission that's been going on for 13.7 billion years, and the Father's house has many dwelling places. And one species decided to go to war against that primary mission. So God decided to take on a secondary mission, which is to try to heal us and bring us back into God's primary mission. And part of our sin is we think we're God's primary mission. That's part of that diva theology. And what we're going to look at tomorrow is how does God do that? But let's go back now. You've seen this part. Let's go back to kind of discussing this. First of all, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense about this kind of understanding of our problem as humans and how it fits into God's bigger picture.
So, I was thinking when God created us, he said, made us in his own image and we're prophets.
Prophets, you said?
Prophets.
Perfect.
Right. So, we went astray and that's why we need to be fixed. Is that correct?
We were never perfect. We were told. Told, good. Okay. Never perfect. And the problem is we've left Tov. But is that getting at what your question is?
Yes, yes, that's it. Yeah, makes sense.
A rabbi friend in seminary had a kind of a similar story. He says that the fall was about the awakening of a different kind of consciousness, that we became aware of our thinking. And as we became self-aware and rational creatures, this was pointing to the all the questions of good and evil that would arise out of that. And that was the beginning of that separation from the divine. And in essence, the formation of a different kind of human ego, which was a whole different take on it from the Jewish perspective. That it was a coming of age, almost a story of emerging into adolescence when we become self-aware, which, you know, it may not sound, but it's very consistent with what you're saying.
Where, I think what we tended to do is, one thought path is that, is, well, let me read something here that I think says what you're saying. This is how we, one way that we responded to this notion of a fall. So here's a person talking. Okay, I know humans shouldn't have eaten from the tree. Big mistake. Our bad. Forgive us. Forgive us, Lord. But now that we have eaten it, and apparently have replaced our innocence with new knowledge, and of course we never go back, so are now living in the real world east of Eden. We tend to think that now is the real world, and back then was some kind of fantasy. How are we going to use our new godlike wisdom? We weren't supposed to have it, but we do now. We are godlike creatures, whether we like it or not, and therefore that we are wiser than any other creature, including, yeah. The question is, how are we going to handle our new responsibility of being rulers of the world? If we don't step up, there will be chaos. We can't let that happen. We must do as much good as we can and not any more evil than we have to. Perhaps we can even develop various religions that will enable us to ask God to work with us in our new role as rulers. I'm suggesting that's going down a wrong path. We never did digest the fruit. Our problem isn't that we're sapient. That's a self-designation number, or we're wise. Our problem is we think we're wise. And we're trying to manage something that only God can manage. It's at the level of life and death. Only God can manage.
You know, Ron, in terms of your narrative, if I understood you, you were talking about an encounter that led to the stories, that, or parable, as you call it. How did the taker-dominant virus, let's call it, spread?
Right. How did it spread?
Because it sounds like one group got overcome by another group.
Yeah, that's a good question. How, if it is possible that there was a time when most human species saw themselves as living as part of the community of life, and that this new narrative took over, how did it take over? And why did it spread? And spread so much so that now it is the dominant narrative of our species. And of course, I don't know the answer to that. One thought is that imagine that you lived in a house with 8 people. And one person had a semi-automatic weapon that they carried around with them in the house. And this person had kind of a volatile personality. That person would really start to affect that whole household. there's something you know, powerful about that kind of aberrant behavior that makes it able to succeed easier than the harder kind of behavior of living responsibly and peacefully. War is easier than peace.
Even more dominant personalities and levels of intellect can force that kind of subjugation on people, you know, and create an advantage to it, similar to it.
Does some of it go back to the Cain-Abel story where you have agricultural communities and nomadic communities that, you know, hurting the whole idea of planting things and making things grow is a lot more like trying to be like God versus just following flocks with the seasons and taking what God's providing.
So that's my book here is called Abel Emerging. And it's not about the Cain-Abel story, but it uses that story as a background template. So Abel would represent cultures that live the first way. And Cain would represent cultures that live the second way. And that Abel cultures, even today, when Cain finds them, Cain rises up to kill them. So you might want to think just in a generalized way that Abel cultures as indigenous peoples. Now, not all indigenous people live this way. But you could make somewhat of a generalization that they tended to live this way. And Cain is not only at war with God, not only at war with God's creation, but is at war with Abel. And whenever Cain finds Abel, Cain manages to destroy Abel's culture, Abel's language, Abel's history. And Cain is also at war with other kings. So I was going to talk more about that tomorrow, but Daniel Quinn talks about, let's say, the Abel world as leaders. They take what is needed and leave the rest. Cain, he talks about as takers. They take and take and take and take and take. They don't even understand the concept. What do you mean, leave the rest? Why would you do that? And whereas this was the dominant narrative of our species for the last couple hundred thousand years, in the last 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 years, this became more and more the dominant species narrative of our species, and that the biblical story was written and told recently to try to describe something they were experiencing and seeing, this change in narrative. Yes, sir.
In Abel's world, then, would it be accurate to say that the coming of Christ is enabling?
I use the phrase, and we'll look at this more tomorrow, but over time, God has sent many Abels to try to lead humanity back into the Father's house. Stoning the prophets, the Abels. And that at one point, God came as Abel of Nazareth. and we'll be getting into that. Yeah.
Do you think at one point the canes, as our population, because we did grow from a very, very tiny bit, yeah, and then probably logarithmically, at one point the canes were just brought physically in close proximity, like you're talking about the AK-47 and, yeah, the group of eight. Yeah. And before that point, there really wasn't that much interaction between the, whatever you call the canes.
Yeah.
The, well, population dynamic.
Well, Abel was no saint. There never was a perfect time. Abel could do all the sins that you do. But Abel never was at the point of annihilating their neighbor. Yeah, there were skirmishes. Yeah, there were wars. There was everything. But something major occurred in this change.
But do you think that part of our growth or our fallback, or not the fall, but was due to population?
Yeah.
Because of our, say, newfound wisdom, we were able to reproduce beyond the carrying capacity or of adjacent populations. And so that may have been what do you think about that possibly being a dynamic in, yeah, in the whole process?
It makes it harder and harder to be an able as the population increases and resources are fewer and so forth.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's... And you bump up against your neighbor more often.
Yeah, rub elbows in a bad way.
It makes it harder. Yeah.
Well, isn't that why we need the interaction of the intervention of God and Jesus? Because it's very hard to be enabled. And how do you be enabled without the help of God? I mean, mm-hmm, how can you sustain that, you know, given our nature?
Mm-hmm. But there are also plenty of teams who do so or act so with, in their feeling anyway, the help of God.
Yeah. Cain has developed his religions. Mm-hmm. We'll explore that more tomorrow. Okay, it's time to break here. I opened up a lot of questions. We can talk during the day and tomorrow. Hopefully as the week goes on, some things will fall into place. And some of you will say, that makes a lot of sense. Some of you will say, nah, that's nuts, and it's fine. But I think it'll stimulate some good discussion. So.